I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello, welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On the show this week, a commissioning slowdown update. We take a look at how Factual is being affected by the ad recession. Also on the programme, put your mouth where the money is. That's what MPs tell the BBC as they get a grilling over their regional plans. All that plus why Joe Lycett is making journalists' lives harder. We welcome NPR to the election cycle. And in the media quiz, it's your favourite media stats. That's all coming up in this edition of the Media Podcast. In the news this week, Hugh Grant has settled his lawsuit against The Sun after the newspaper offered what he called an enormous sum of money. He posted online, "I would love to see all the allegations that they deny tested in court, but the rules around civil litigation mean that if I proceed to trial and the court awards me damages that are even a penny less than the settlement offer, I would have to pay the legal costs of both sides." There's been surprise in the world of football journalism as news spread last week that the Times star writer Henry Winter has been axed on the same day that the Mail's own sports desk said it should expect redundancies soon. And the actor Olivia Williams has spoken about her experience working on Friends in the late 90s, calling it alarming and harrowing. She told The Independent, "Friends was a brand and you had to fit the brand and that involved essentially plucking off your eyebrows. I said, please don't take my eyebrows off. I might need them in another job." That's the sense in which it was harrowing. Well, here with me in the London podcast studios, eyebrows intact, we welcome back the MD of Goldwaller, the TV industry's second favourite Osman. It's Faraz Osman.
Oh, I was waiting for this to come out, like, yeah, or the media podcast industry's second favourite Osman. I mean, like, cool, we're not related. He's more successful than me. Fine, I'm cool with it. Find me another Faraz that works in media. That's the thing I'm taking. Like, you know,
are you a Faraz? Yeah. Get in touch. Have you pitched any docs about air fryers recently?
No, although I have got a doc. What's an air fryer do? I was going to say bubbling in my head. What's an air fryer do? Steaming
things
in my head?
No, cooking.
I've got a doc cooking up that's got nothing to do with air fryers, but it's taking inspiration. Look, the thing about the air fryer docs. Now everyone's like sneers at it. It rates. They continue to rate, and not just on telly, but people are still buying them. Like, ads are still going out. There's cookbooks around air fryers, you know. And I think that Ben Frown's What Channel 5 do incredibly well. It's zeitgeisty, I think is a word.
I love an air fryer. Next to Faraz, we welcome back the MD of Talented People, the headhunting company for TV craft people. It's Kimberly Godbolt. Hello.
Hello, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm very good. You have a talk this evening. It's called Where Have All the PMs Gone? Surely the answer is GB News.
Oh yeah, so he's just woken up. This report is an academic report that has just come out. Academia is very slow, so although the title might be a bit misleading because everyone's going, well, the PMs are all still here because there's no work at the moment.
So this is PMs for production managers.
It's production managers. So a couple of years ago, you probably remember, we all had a massive problem booking any level of production manager. You couldn't find them for love nor money. And the good people of Bournemouth University have produced a report to put into tangible statistics what we all sensed and felt about why production managers were difficult to recruit, hard to retain. And the event this evening is the launch of this report, which I hope everybody reads, discussing things like the lack of visibility of the roles, why the image of a production manager is not quite as sexy as editorial, the divide between production and editorial, and the things that we can all be doing or should all be doing to help keep brilliant people in the business.
Well, let's stay with issues in TV for our first story. Documentary features are under threat, according to a panel of top producers who came together at BAFTA this week, including those behind Three Identical Strangers, as well as the hit new documentary Superman. For us, the main issue highlighted was how few docs make money back. Why is that?
Well, there's a lot of them get made, firstly. Yeah. And this is the thing about screen industries, is that there is like a whole space of people that do it, I don't want to say as a hobby, but it's like so passionate about it that it will do anything to get their story made. And so a lot of films get made, and then when they get made, they're all trying to kind of like vie for attention. Film festivals are part of that. Obviously, they're all looking for funding and distribution, etc.
And docs can be done by small indies as well, or small single-person operations. We see that often in radio as well.
Yeah, but I think even in indie film as well, so many indie films get made. Mm. Like it's just one of these things about the creative industries that like lots more stuff gets made than you will ever see. And this is the result of it, that like actually, you know, it is a bit of a numbers game, but also it is an industry game as well. Like if you go off and make your own documentary and you didn't get funding in the first place or distribution in the first place and you took all the risk, you are then kind of almost like pushing that risk back and back and back to a point where you're a bit like, right, now I've made my film, now can somebody else take the risk and pay for it? So, you know, it is a numbers game. The figures don't massively surprise me. They are terrifying, but they don't massively surprise me. But the other thing to say as well is that this industry has changed so significantly in that you always need to find funding from so many different partners now. The days of kind of going to a channel and saying, do you like this idea? Yes, I do. Here's your 100% budget to get commissioned, go and make the film and you can distribute it. Those days are gone.
What are you getting from a channel? What percentage of things?
I mean, look, if you're doing a premium doc, it completely depends on if the doc is about the UK. Like there's a film that came out recently on Channel 4 that's incredible. I urge everyone to watch it, called Defiance, three-part documentary about, I was going to say a word I don't think I'm allowed to say on radio, but it's about the race hate around South Asian people when they came to this country, and it's an amazing documentary. It was part funded by Motion Content Group, and they were the co-producer partners with Rogan Productions and Left Handed. It's taken a while to get across the line. That is a very British story. Does that have distribution outside of the UK? Probably not. So
why are Motion interested in that?
So, well, I can't say because I don't work for Motion. Yeah. I can't, you know, I don't know the full ins and outs of it. But it is a premium documentary, and it makes sense that Motion actually have a deal with Channel 4 which we've been recipients of, called the Diverse Indie Fund, where they are looking to, you know, allow for more diverse producers to make content. It doesn't always have to be about diverse stories. This just happens to be that. There are really wonky reasons why they do it, because it's to do with the ad spend in the, you know, and the ad sales of the adverts in between the programs, and they do deals before that's allocated, etc., which is why Motion are involved, and it causes all sorts of issues. And you know, some people are very pro it, some people are quite anti it, some people don't, like me, don't completely understand it. But that documentary, three-part documentary about British culture, I would argue, even 10 years ago, that would have been fully funded by a channel. Mm. Now it requires lots of different people to get involved before it can get to screen. And you're seeing more and more documentaries and high-end dramas needing to lean into that, what I think is like a more of a film producer role of getting lots of different pots of money before they can actually get enough money to budget the whole thing.
I mean, Kimberly, is that a new role which kind of indies require, sort of people to go off and find all these different sources of revenue? Is that an in-demand role?
Increasingly. When we're asked to recruit for senior people, we're often now seeing that, you know, must have done deals and know how to negotiate partnerships from new sources. And, you know, it's not a surprise that things are going in that direction. It's really interesting for us that you say that it's like a film kind of producer's head, because I'd not really thought about it like that before. But you have to be able to have, you have to have a kind of a portfolio master plan, not only in terms of the range of things that you are now having to make as a content maker, but how you're going to get funding to make it. I think, you know, it's, and also going back to that article, how can, there's so few people who can afford to make their own independently funded self-finance thing anyway. I mean, it amazed me that there were 5,000 people who, you know, submit a film to Sundance, and, you know, and then only five of them actually, you know, got any decent return from it anyway. But it feels like there's not that many people in the world of sort of TV broadcast that can afford to do that anyway.
I guess also with multiple partners, you're compromising because people have different views and you have to kind of take that on board.
Potentially. I mean, you could also argue that in some instances, you might go the other way, because, like, you know, if you've got more partners, you're thinking about a broader audience, and therefore your opportunities to get access and to open up the story could mean that it becomes a better film as a result. I mean, I would argue that you look at the incredible natural history documentaries that we have that do require funding from lots of different partners now. There are very few places you can make those from a single funder. That they are amazing because they reflect the whole of our planet. So that's a good thing. But there are quintessentially British stories that I think are still important to us as a nation that I think are becoming harder to make because of the current market. And I do think that's problematic. But we have seen this in film and in animation. You are seeing multiple partners that come together to fund these things. And actually, increasingly, the pressure is on the production companies to find that money before. So they will get a green light from a UK broadcaster, but it will be for like 20% of the money. And they will take that green light to then go and broker money from lots of other places as well. It's a tricky thing.
Does that kind of commitment to pay the 20%, does that run for a certain amount of time? Have you got a year? Have you got 6 months to get the rest of the cash together?
I mean, look, every deal is different, and it completely depends on what the idea is. It completely depends on who. I will say that me as an indie and the experiences that I've had, and I think this is becoming rarer, a vast majority of stuff that we've done has been fully commissioned from at source. But as the market gets trickier and trickier, we are looking for funding outside of the UK and starting to understand how that works. And it's complicated because it's not like, you know, we have a commissioning setup in this country. And like, as a producer that's only ever made stuff in this country, you just assume that you do what you do there, but over in the Middle East or over in the Americas or over in Africa. But actually, every single space has got a completely different way of working. Some broadcasters are completely owned by the state, some are completely commercial, some are owned by brands. You've just got to keep shopping around in a different way and putting different hats on.
I mean, Kimberly, there is some news about high-end documentaries able to claim tax relief of 34%. That's not bad, is it?
No, that sounds like it. I mean, we've all got to find ways to save money right now, so that feels like an incentive. And to Fraz's point about having almost more partners on board as an advantage, I agree with that. It's complex and it's time consuming to get everybody on board, and you need to have a really good system of communication and an overarching agreement on the shape it's going to take and the direction it needs to be and how it's going to look and feel. But actually, bringing on specialists from different areas with different opinions can be a really good thing. I'm a massive fan of partnerships.
Okay, over to the BBC, who've been criticised this week by drumroll, MPs for their plans to move production across the UK in a project the broadcaster calls Across the UK. Kimberly, what did MPs on the Public Accounts Committee say?
Well, they were not happy about it because they felt that, you know, that the money that was being allocated to outside of London did not have a purpose. It's almost like everyone was patting themselves on the back for having A, saved some money, and then B, gone, and we're going to spend it outside of London, which everybody wants. Yay, our job is done. And then everyone outside of London's going, well, and probably in London is going, yes, but what actually are you going to do with that money? I mean, it's a bit like, I don't know, me taking money out of my joint bank account with my husband and going, oh, well, I've trimmed costs everywhere else, so I'm just going to take this money and run off somewhere with it. And I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do with it. Probably spend it in Oliver Bonus.
That's basically how BBC Commercial Affairs works. It's exactly the same.
And obviously it's mixed in with MPs being kind of unhappy about cuts to local radio and that side as well.
Yeah, I think the local radio thing has obviously created a real flashpoint because, you know, as MPs, they go to their constituents, have their surgeries, and local radio.
Well, also they would like to be on the local radio. This is the core thing. It's like they do not want anything to disappear that stops them be able to.
I do look, that may well be true, but I think that from our perspective as an industry, the issue with this is things like local radio are training grounds for a lot of incredible creatives that go on and have brilliant careers, or they are great spaces to have little cottage industries of media, which I also think are really important as well. When you
aren't we best putting people in Cardiff, Manchester, Glasgow, Birmingham, and creating scale rather than little bits everywhere?
But I think if you get rid of local radio, that regular work that's created, you know, if they have purpose to create something. I think sometimes we forget the value of that because on a spreadsheet you can't really quantify it. And you know, I do a lot of work in children's television, and the same thing is true with children's television. You see cuts left, right, and centre for kids' TV because it's hard to quantify how you go from being a writer on a kid's drama all the way up to writing Succession, you know, which exactly is what happened. Presenters, are many, many presenters and talents and entertainment producers and filmmakers and scriptwriters, they all do start in children's television, but there's not a kind of direct one-to-one relationship between the money that's spent there and how it ends up in the pockets of the whole of the UK creative economy. And the same is true with local radio. So I think there's a bit of a struggle at the moment to find, for instance, podcast producers, which is where a lot of the audio work is right now, outside of London. Because if we're going to lose local radio, then where's the market for them to kind of find their training and get... If all of the regular audio work is in London, you're going to just create a bit of an issue with the market and the supply of the workforce.
Well, in TV, they're doing quite well on their plan. Their plan is to shift 60% of production outside of London by 2027, and they're at 58% now. I mean, they set some targets, and they've pretty much achieved them.
Mm. I think they were also unhappy that more money was going into online rather than radio. And I suppose...
Oh, that internet, it'll never work.
Exactly. I'm thinking of the older demographic, and maybe all these MPs who are upset are in the older generation. I don't know. Maybe that's an unfair comment.
But TV... I want to quantify this for people to stop shouting at me in the comments below. So the issue is that you can pick up a big brand like MasterChef or Weakest Link and move it to a different city, and that will have a almost overnight impact as a result of that. You can't really do the same with local radio. You need to have that regular work, and audio just doesn't work in the same way because we don't have like audio formats or audio shows created in the same way, and so as a result it's harder to kind of move those jobs in certain places. And I think the problem that sometimes the BBC fall victim to is they want to use the same model for everything.
Yes.
But they're making so many different types of thing that it's not simple by going, well, you've done it in TV, so why can you not do it online?
Also, I think if you're moving Weakest Link, you're sort of moving 50 to 100 people's jobs and roles, and that's training, and you've got to do a lot of work to build all the infrastructure
exactly.
to do that. If you pick up Saturday Live and move it to Cardiff, there's probably 5 or 6 people that are moving right. there. And it's harder to say we're building a new industry in Cardiff, as I imagine some of those people might just have travelled from London.
So yeah, but also like radio by its very nature, you know, kind of like how we're doing here, is generally people sitting in a studio behind a microphone or playing some records. Mm. It's not the same as creating a whole set or, you know, doing all the casting or, you know, getting the camera crews involved. And, you know, there's a difference in both where the contributors travel to and when they get there, what's the most convenient thing for them. And also, as you say, the level of infrastructure that different formats require.
If you're listening to this, I'd love to know what you think about that, actually. Why not drop us a note at the Media Podcast on Twitter or through our website. BBC Performance. Deadline reports this week that the BBC are considering applying performance-related pay to its top earners, both on and off the screen. Kimberly, lots of other companies do this. Why not the BBC?
I don't know, actually. And I don't think it's a bad thing.
Mm.
You know, in any private company, you have to perform well. You have KPIs, you have, you know, performance-related meetings, and, you know, you get compensated depending on how well you do. BBC as a public service needs to do the right thing by everyone. And so why not only reward the people who are meeting their performance targets?
Farage, should Gary Lineker get more cash if ratings go up?
Yeah, I think that's actually kind of part of the problem around this, is because what is performance when it comes to the BBC? Is it better representation? Is it bigger? Is it higher audience figures?
Appreciation scores?
You know, exactly. Is it you've kind of done some more stuff in the regions? Like, you know, those metrics and how they get hit. It's difficult to say what is important when what's not that they're not important, but what it means, what high performance in the BBC, or not just the BBC, but any public body actually means. And the concern with this is that you push it further and further into kind of more of a privatisation model, which is like, well, okay, we're going to base it around the same metrics that ITV have, for instance, which is around ratings and how much
and revenue.
How much value you're returning to the shareholders.
Well, BBC Studios wants to make some money. Maybe they should.
BBC Studios is different, though. I think that BBC Studios should have performance related pay. That does make sense. They're a commercial organisation, and they need to, you know, the people working there need to demonstrate that they're returning commercial value. The BBC isn't a commercial organisation, so are you going to say that you're going to give people bonuses based on their public service performance?
Could
maybe
do.
But I think it's a complication. If I was working at the BBC, I'd like to know what this means. If I was working in, like, I don't know, the religion department, are you saying that I need to represent more religions, or I need to get a higher audience, or I need to have the Church of England write a letter saying that they're very happy with what we've done? It's difficult to know.
But if it's about individual performance, is that what it's about? Individual? Because if it's individual performance, then that's, I think you don't need to represent how well or the BBC has performed or your programme has performed. It's actually how well have you done your job. Therefore, you know, is your pay then deserving of an increase? That's how I sort of read it.
It'd be interesting to, obviously, if you're a top earner at the BBC, you are listed on the PDF of doom that comes out every year that everyone worries about. It would be interesting having to describe that in a bit more detail, why somebody has gone up on the list.
Yeah, I think if you've met criteria or you've exceeded something that was personal to you in your job that you needed to deliver, then you should be rewarded for that, and I'd be cool with that.
I just would like to see a bit more scrutiny about what performance means at the BBC, particularly those top earners. But I keep coming back to, you know, this is a conversation we have all the time. People who work at the BBC get paid less than the rest of the industry, right? I mean, it's just a fact, and it's like, you know, I know that we all like going, oh, it's the BBC and it's a licence fee, it's paid for, this, that and the other. The standard of work that producers at the BBC produce for less money is, you know, it's exceptional. And, you know, yes, maybe they should get paid more, but what we're going to do, cut more services? It's a zero-sum game at the BBC. They have a certain amount of money at the licence fee, and we've got to be careful about kind of saying they need to be paid more because they performed well, or is this by stealth giving lots of people a pay cut, which we need to be careful about?
Well, of course, they still have to get it past unions like Bec2, so we will see how they get on. Okay, we're going to be talking Joe Lycett after this.
The BAFTA TV Awards with P&O Cruisers are coming. I'm Alex Zane, and this week on Countdown to the BAFTAs, it's all things live as we look at the biggest events and sporting fixtures of the last year. Find out how ending a live sports broadcast is even more important than the result. The actress turned TV host who has had an incredible 12 months and looking to boost your show's ratings, why the answer is always naked people. That's Countdown to the BAFTAs. Find us wherever you get your podcasts and tune in on the 12th of May on BBC One and iPlayer to discover the winners.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome back. Kimberly and Faraz are here for some more news in brief. Comedian Joe Lycett returned to Channel 4 on Friday, launching a new series of his late night show with a publicity stunt involving fake stories in the press. Kimberly, can you name any of those stories?
I wish it had been the one that I saw people talking about online, which was the woman in Cheshire who rescued what she thought was a small baby hedgehog and brought it into her local RSPCA, and in fact turned out to be a bobble hat.
Incredible.
We've all done it.
Wish it had been that. But no, it wasn't one. The footballer with a... Was it with a bruise in the shape of Harry?
Of Prince Harry, yes, that's correct. Yeah. Fraz, can you recall
that? I did see it. What I enjoyed is all the ones that we thought it was, exactly as Kimberly said. There was a lot of chat that, and I really wish this was true, because it would have been an incredible media story, which was the Willy Wonka experience and whether or not that was all set up by Joe Lycett. It was a brilliant idea. What a great way to launch a series, get everyone talking about it. You know, it's just exceptional social campaigning.
So just so everyone knows,
it can be done on telly as well.
Maybe. So a statue of H from UK pop group Steps being erected in his Welsh hometown. Research showing that men from Birmingham are the best endowed in the UK. And a new Banksy mural of Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, again in Birmingham. Well done to all of that. I mean, it totally did the job of establishing the show.
We're going to be the bores, aren't we? We're going to say the same thing, aren't we? We're going to be like, okay, we're going to be in fun police now, aren't we?
Journalists not happy, but they printed stuff which wasn't true.
I think that the point that Joe was trying to make is that it is really easy to get these stories out there. Therefore, the problem with it is that it ends up going, well, you shouldn't trust the news network and you shouldn't trust any news. Everything's fake news. You should just assume that everything's fake until Joe Lycett says it's not and has a bit of a kind of comedy gotcha moment. I'm not sure how much public good that does. It's funny. Don't get me wrong. I think it's very, very funny. But the long-term impact of that is going, well, okay, that Willy Wonka story you saw, it's probably somebody's probably behind it. And look, we all know that PR companies do a very good job in placing stories that may not necessarily be completely factually accurate or have the historical background that they say it does.
Also, sometimes journalists like writing up a fun story, and I've done enough over the years for kind of radio related things.
Yeah.
Because it's just, it either fills the paper, something for the end of the broadcast.
Yeah. And this is, a lot of these are fun, but as we kind of, you know, without being the fun police, as we race towards the year of the most elections across our planet, you know, this is an issue. We are all talking about AI and how that's going to kind of impact stuff. All of these things are conversations that are live right now. I guess from Joe's point of view, he's a bit like, well, this is my way of bringing attention to that issue. From my point of view, I'm a bit like, have you not just kind of put... What's that phrase where you put something in the soup? You've like muddied the waters a bit more. That's what I'm looking for. And that's kind of my concern about this, is a bit like, you know, what's going to be the long tail impact of this? Every time a new series of Joe Lycett comes out, are people going to start going, well, any story that's fantastical isn't real?
But what great positioning that is for him.
That's amazing.
I am the one that does all these things.
Yeah, for him and the entertainment show. And listen, this isn't the first time this happened. I remember there's been all sorts of TV shows where it's a bit like, let's see if we can get on this morning sofa by pretending to be somebody. This is not the first time this has gone on. I think the key issue with this is that he's based it around news and he's tried to hoodwink the news media. And we need to have a proper debate around... are there enough checks and balances in place before those stories get out there? And, you know, in many instances there aren't. And I would argue, in many instances, that's because newsrooms are chronically underfunded right now.
Kimberly, a lot of this has come from Chris Sawyer, who was an ex-Radio 1 producer. This is Greg James' producer, who loves doing a stunt. That's basically, it was his main job on the Radio 1 breakfast show. I'm sure he's had quite a hand in this one. It definitely... seems like he's got his fingerprints. It does show that you can switch channels, switch formats, switch media, and bring different skills to different people.
Yeah. I mean, I just... What what worries me slightly about this is that there is a basic level of trust, isn't there, between reporter and source. And, you know, there's so much information, you know, entering our brains from all different places. It's on the one hand, it's a good thing, isn't it, to flag good journalism and, you know, rigorous checking. But on the other, like, we are all demanding an excessive amount of content and loving it at the same time. So how do we consolidate that? I don't know. News is quicker than ever.
You want a statue of H from Steps to be true.
I really do.
That's the genius of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I know this sounds... I am the fun police, and this sounds utterly ludicrous. But, like, we had a similar story, which was true, which is when Mohamed Al-Fayed made a statue of Michael Jackson and put it outside Fulham Football Club.
Yeah.
You know, we've had the crazy statue of... Was it Ronaldo that was at an airport? Mm. Like, those are real stories, and by doing this, we kind of go, oh, actually, maybe they weren't real stories, and I'm struggling to see. But also,
does it do a good job actually of pointing out there are certain methods to media which everybody just defaults to, and whether you're a journalist who is used to receiving press releases and you write it up and you know it gets clicks and. This is somebody sort of sticking a fork in that machine.
I think, to be honest, and I confess I haven't yet watched the show, and if this is what they've done, then I think that this is, you know, in balance, this is a good thing. If he was a bit like, look, we put out this press release, if anybody called the number at the bottom of the press release to check the story, we would have told them it was fake. Then I'm like, cool, this is a funny idea, and they prank the media, and I'm into that. But if it is actually, we place these stories, and we place enough evidence out there that, like, you could corroborate the stories, and therefore this is how we got into the press. Mm. If their motivation was, we want to get it on the BBC News website, so we did everything we could to get it on the BBC News website, that is problematic, because, like I said, journalists are, you know, newsrooms are underfunded, journalists are underpaid, and they're under incredible amounts of pressure to break news every 15 seconds. And if they are... going through the usual checks and balances, and you've got people that are surreptitiously trying to circumvent that, then I think you're the bad person in that story, because you're trying to make people, you're trying to make journalists look bad. But if he's saying, oh no, we put a press release out, you should have checked it because it's a stupid story, they didn't check it and they went ahead and printed it, then I think, yeah, this is a legitimate way of holding up a mirror to how we got our news out.
Well, Kimberly, it's been 16 years since Nick Davies published Flat Earth News, which highlighted how reliant journalists sort of became on PRs. So he sort of coined the term churnalism of, you know, taking these PR material and sort of making stories. I mean, this kind of comes back to jobs and funding. Is journalism at the mercy of PRs? Is that actually what maybe Joe Lycett's proved?
Probably. I mean, I don't think there is enough money, time, resource to absolutely rigorously check absolutely everything. There just isn't. Mm. And PRs should also want to be doing good jobs. Of course, they want their stuff in the wider press, but they also need to have a level of professionalism and fact-checking and all of that stuff. So it's a basic level of trust, I think. And we're sort of in a new era of journalism, aren't we, where there are probably only a certain level of trusted sources, and the rest we are probably a bit cynical about.
Well, I mean, this is, I think, not to bring up one of the best news stories of the year, which is Kate Middleton's photo. You know, this is in the same space of that, where Kensington Palace was seen as a trusted news source, and they've lost that reputation now because they doctored a photo. And so when news agencies and wires do realise that something's not quite right, they come down on it very, very heavy-handed, because you are breaking, you know, the contract of trust between the news wires and the journalists and the audience.
And finally, just before the quiz, a public broadcaster criticised by an employee forced to report on its own handling of the situation. Not, it turns out, the BBC. This one's NPR in America. Kimberly, the senior editor, Yuri Berliner, who quit on Thursday after being suspended by NPR for comments he made publicly. What's he been saying?
So he said that he felt that the network had lost America's trust due to a sort of a perceived progressive bias. Mm. And he was arguing for a more balanced approach. But I don't know. I mean, I didn't know a lot about NPR, in all honesty. But no, it seems that, I mean, it's a public service broadcaster, isn't it, in America, and it is widely regarded for its impartiality and a trusted news source. And we've been talking about trust a lot, obviously, just now. So I get it, but it appears that he's sort of thrown his toys out of the pram and gone to talk publicly about his feelings, and sort of broken all the rules about that, when it comes to sort of the journalism code and his contract, probably. But then NPR have done the same thing. Oh, well, he's talking, so we're talking, and now it's all got very messy. I mean, they say that, you know, that they're emphasising the importance of diversity and healthy discussion within the organisation, but I don't really know how this is playing out very well.
It's interesting that the younger employees, who are maybe on the more progressive side, perhaps aren't such a fan of him either.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is that there is this kind of curiosity about how we think that younger people working in the media are always like lefty and progressive. And I actually think that there are certain things that have come out recently that suggest that that may not always be the case. You know, NPR is a real curiosity within America. It's like PBS, you know, it is. Then it's much, much smaller than the BBC.
Yeah, so you've got kind of like a national operation, which is sort of NPR, and then there are sort of local affiliates that are normally local operations, yeah. That take some of their programming.
And no surprise, they continue to punch way above their weight when it comes to, you know, be it Sesame Street or be it This American Life. And I think that it...
And both PBS and NPR are always have funding issues, and should they be funded by the US government?
Yeah, there was
Should it be all listener or advertising?
Yeah, you know, it's another part of the culture war. It's not like the BBC here, because I think the BBC is so much bigger as an institution in this country. But there is people that have real issues with the fact that there is a public broadcaster in America, and I don't think it should exist. Surprise, surprise. I don't think it's, you know, you could probably guess who the people are that have an issue with a public service broadcaster in America. But I think that a lot of people, my understanding is that it has a very, very high trust level within America, both PBS and NPR. And people are very, very loyal to it. They all go around with tote bags. They're very, very loyal to it. And much like people are very loyal to Radio 4 in this country. So anybody that kind of rocks the boat, either editorially or kind of criticizes it in any way, it's a little bit like criticizing the royal family. Yes, there may be some problems, but you have to be very brave to say anything about it.
Okay, just enough time for the media quiz. And this week it's the return of Stat Attack. Of course, you'll remember from episode 212, when we did this before. I'm going to give you a stat. It may well just be a number, and you need to tell me what media story it relates to from the week. Buzz in with your names if you know the answer. Ooh. So Kimberly, you will say...
Kimberly.
Faraz, you will say...
Faraz.
Let's play Stat Attack. Question number one. The first stat is 11%. That's 11%.
Oh, Kimberly.
Kimberly.
I forgot my name for a second. Is this to do with the gender pay gap?
It is.
Yeah.
This is the average gender pay gap across UK media organisations. That's 34 organisations who are big enough to be counted in government reporting. Kimberly, did you see the chart? Did you see who was on there?
I was going to say, Kimberly, you paid 11% less than everyone else.
Or more.
No, I didn't see the chart. I just, when I read that there was only 34 organisations big enough to have to provide their stats, I found that quite depressing. I'm like, well, what about all the companies that are small and really rubbish with the pay divide?
Yes. Do you see that with your clients?
I mean, people are pretty cagey about disclosure of the you know, very top level people's salaries. Mm. We're definitely seeing more women in leadership roles for sure, but in terms of the pay parity in those you know, sort of MD level C-suite roles, difficult to say.
Faraz, did you see who was at the bottom of the list?
Was it me?
Well, there was Bloomberg, News Group, Mirror Group, and GB News.
I mean. It is quite shocking, and I think that my favourite thing is International Women's Day, where there's I think it was a bot that came out on Twitter where they would every time anybody from any organisation would say something about International Women's Day, this bot would scrape that data and say what their gender pay gap is as that organisation, which is so much fun.
Brilliant.
And I think that level of transparency is a good thing all round. And you know what, I think that to Kimberly's point, these are the big companies that have to report this. And when you report it, you kind of, you have to hold your feet to the fire to it.
Well done to the BBC and Haymarket, who had one of the lowest gaps. Right, question number two. Next stat is simply 1%.
That's 1%.
I'll let you have that
one. It's the 1% club, right?
Yes.
It's ITV's hit new entertainment format.
ITV's biggest original game show in a decade, according to Broadcast. Have you seen it?
Yeah, love it. It's great.
It's sort of non-celebrity squares.
It's not, well, I'll tell you what it is it's really good family viewing, which is the holy grail right now. Finding like good shows that the whole family can sit around and watch, I think, is the new thing that everyone wants. You know, post-Gladiators, obviously, that's the thing that everyone's talking
is
about.
Is that just because you and I have got kids of the age where we
that.
Can sit and watch
you'd
at 7
that.
O'clock?
You could think that, but I do actually think it is, it is reality. You know, they've tried a lot of things at Saturday night to kind of get it to work. You know, there's been dramas, there's been all sorts, but actually it's the shows that whole families can sit around and watch.
Kimberly, do your family sit around and watch the 1% Club?
We don't watch the 1% Club, actually. We are just getting into it. Mm-hmm. But yes, Gladiators was a big thing.
Masked Singer, big kids
show. Yeah. What I loved is that kind of, it was recapturing that event style. Come on, guys, you've got to eat your dinner quick. Come on, because otherwise there might be a spoiler. Someone will tell you who got through to the semi-final. You know, really, really enjoying that.
I did enjoy on Twitter this week what looked like about a 2-year-old doing all of the poses from Gladiators.
Oh, so good. It's so good.
Excellent. Okay, question number three. This is a number sequence. 2, 40, 2, 7. What does it mean?
Oh, I was going somewhere like it might have been about ratings of some sort, but it's not. 2, 40... 2, 7.
Well, it's really obvious. It means that Mark Goody is hosting Pick of the Pops, of course.
Oh, I see. 2 top 40. Well, what's the 7, though? 2, 7 p.m.?
So, Radio 2, every week covering the top 40 from 2 charts across 7 decades.
Oh, yeah. I mean, obvious. How could that not be more obvious?
I mean, when I read that article, I was like, I'm sorry, what? I had to read that sentence 3 times.
Isn't it Mark Goodyear was my first ever boss, so I'm
delighted. I thought you were going to say crush for a minute.
Maybe that too.
He's a lovely, lovely chap, and I think this is brilliant news.
Yeah, so Kimberly, Mark's been on Greatest Hits Radio recently. Sort of the BBC is his home, and charts are very much his thing. It's a good booking.
Yeah, it really is. He's nostalgia value. He's quality. I think he does well with kids as well, but we all remember him from Radio 1. He did Radio 1, yeah, didn't he? I'm remembering that right. Yeah, all sorts. No, I think it's a respectful and, you know, really exciting hire.
And that makes our winner a draw.
Me?
No, it's a draw. One apiece, which means together...
We're both in the 1% club.
together you can go off and get some news stories positioned in other news titles all about the Media Podcast.
That was almost as complicated as the last question you asked.
Right.
Just like Joe Lycett. You've just got to get some of this in the show.
Fine. I thought you were going to say we could go and drink some Jägermeister from your waiting room.
Get our eyebrows waxed.
Maybe that too. My thanks to Faraz Osman and Kimberly Godbolt. Where can people keep up with all of your activities, Kimberly?
Oh, at Talented People and talentedpeople.tv. And our podcast, The Imposter Club, is still alive and kicking if you want to go and check that out.
Get it. Wherever you're listening to this, Faraz?
Gold_Waller is what we're doing at Goldwaller. That's everywhere that you'll find us. I wanted to say the last time I saw Kimberly was in a karaoke booth in London. Like, we've managed to go the whole show without mentioning this. Kimberly is so good at her job that she managed to hoodwink me. I mean, I'm a sober man and I think karaoke is the worst invention of all time, yet somehow, because Kimberly is brilliant at what she does, I ended up in a karaoke booth, and now we're discussing kind of starting a business of doing TV theme tunes karaoke.
Oh, that'd be good for the sector.
Yeah, exactly.
Kimberly, what did Faraz sing? Can you remember?
You can. You're going to tell me. She signed an NDA.
What was the duet? We did a duet. Or was that you and someone else who may not or may not want to be mentioned? Honestly, I think people probably would have paid to watch Fly on the Wall for that karaoke booth, because we had Beck 2 and the TV Mindset Talented People and a couple of indies in that karaoke booth.
I think we need to get some of the audio and put it on the Patreon feed.
That's the answer.
I think what you need to do is, like, unless you pay the Patreon fee, we'll put that audio on the feed.
Yes.
That's good. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's it today from the Media Podcast. Remember, there's 25% off your first booking at the London Podcast Studios, where we record our show each week. All you got to do is use the code MEDIAPOD. So just head to thelondonpodcaststudios.com for 25% off with the code MEDIAPOD. And if you're new to the show, remember to hit follow in your podcast app of choice so you'll get an alert of all of our new episodes. My name is Matt Deegan. The producer was Matt Hill. It was a Rethink Audio production. I'll see you next week.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Monday, it's the anniversary of the table knife being invented.
On Tuesday, we explain how the tradition of the two-minute silence originated in Cape Town.
On Wednesday, we recall the day King George III proved he was assassin-proof.
On Thursday, let's all eat cake. It's Marie Antoinette's wedding.
And on Friday, we discover how Buffalo Bill helped invent the Wild West.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.